Okay. I'll call this meeting of the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness to order. The first order of business, first, thank you all for attending and being willing to participate. But our first item of business today will be our organizational meeting to adopt the rules. So I will open the organizational meeting.
Chair Lively, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, February 3rd, 2015.
Thank you. Representative Boone moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today. Is there any discussion? You probably all have seen or heard of these rules previously.
Our rules.
We'll wait for a second for Representative Parrish and then we'll.
I
figure they're probably brand new. You've never seen them before.
No.
Okay. Any discussion of the rules? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. Okay. So while we're still in organizational meeting, I'll call upon members to introduce themselves. And as they introduce themselves, you also talk about how long you've served on this committee. So, Representative Huffman.
All righty. Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Huffman from House District 59, been in the Dalles for the last 30 years. This is my second term on this committee, and I'm a disabled veteran, not a wounded warrior or anything. It was an embarrassing training accident, so we won't go there.
I don't want to.
So I'm very familiar with the VA system, and so I bring that kind of perspective to the committee. But anything else? Did I cover it well enough?
No, you get your chance, though. But
I'm kind of the veterans highway guy. You'll find out from the committee.
I had some indication of that.
I have all the. Veteran highway bills. It seems like I'm the adoptee to do that. So
that's good. No, I appreciate it. Okay.
Carla Peluso, representative, brand new representative, District 50 Gresham. I have served on this committee, I think, now for 7 minutes. So I am very happy to be here, happy to learn. I am a proud daughter of a World War II vet. My background is law enforcement, 30 years with the Gresham Police Department. So I put that kind of under the military umbrella as well. So I am honored to be here, honored to serve.
Thank you.
Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. Been on this committee, I think, 6 or 8 years. Debbie and I have been on it the same amount of time, whatever it is. I am 30% disabled from military service from Agent Orange in Vietnam, and I was in country for 1 year. So been there, done that. So, but looking forward to seeing how well we do. We have a lot of good people on this committee.
Thank you. So let's go down here to the other end of the dais. So Paul, if you'd like to introduce yourself. Sorry, I switched it over. So.
Yes, sir. Paul Evans, House District 20, Monmouth Independence, West Salem, South Salem. Several years back, I used to serve as a policy advisor to Governor Kulongoski. My priority mission for the next 2 years on this committee is to help fill in the gaps for things that we weren't able to get accomplished then and to improve upon those things. To make sure that our resiliency emergency management program is the best in the country, and to make sure that the 900 kids that are coming back from the Guard, as well as the 300 that come back every month, have a place to go and something to do so we don't have to have more tragedies. So that's why I'm on this committee. This is the committee I wanted. I'm very happy to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you. So Julie Parrish from House District 37. This is my third term on this committee. It's actually the only committee I will have continuously stayed on, as I've been bounced around other places and tried other committees. I am the wife of a Army veteran who spent two tours in Iraq, once in the first Gulf War and once as a post 9/11 veteran. Strong military family, have a brother who served, a brother-in-law who's currently in the Navy. We don't hold that against him at family dinners. And in this Gulf War, my father actually served as a contractor to the Army and was a translator for about 18 months. And so just very strong military ties outside of the building and the policies that I'm working on in here. I am co-chair of Keeping Our Promise, which is the goal to get lottery dollars dedicated permanently and with Martha Schrader. She's my cohort on that. We're hoping to get that to the ballot in 2016. So veterans issues are near and dear to my heart, and glad to be on this committee. I think of all the committees I serve on, this one tends to work very well together, and really a lot of heart for especially some of the folks who've been on this committee before, that we really do try to keep this as nonpartisan as possible, and I am very appreciative of that, as veterans issues should not be partisan issues, and so appreciate the colleagues coming back and looking forward to working with new ones on the committee.
Thank you.
I'm Deb Boone. I represent the beautiful upper left coast of our state, and as Representative Esquivel says, we have served on this together for, I'm thinking it might be 8 years. I'm not sure.
I think so.
It's hard to keep track of what we do here. Sometimes we're here forever. And this committee has been conjoined with others, as it is now with emergency preparedness, but I also sat on it when it was just Veterans Committee. And I'm not a veteran, but I have a father-in-law who's now gone, and he was a World War II vet, and my uncle was a World War II vet, and they each served in the different theaters, one in my uncle in the Pacific and my father-in-law in Europe, and who was a P-38 flyer, and I got to sit in one in the Tillamook Air Museum once, and full appreciation for someone who sits in that confined space where your hands are like this. You can't even turn sideways. So my job is to continue my work advocating for our veterans. And this time around, I'm going to focus a little further on work with people who are working with homeless vets, both women and men, and hopefully getting something in my area of the North Coast, something for our homeless vets up there. And continuing with the healthcare situation that we've got going, we have clinics and getting more transportation services should they need them, and joining my good buddy here on her lottery issue. And most importantly, making sure you all do what you're supposed to do. Most of you have military training, so all I should have to do is look at you and kind of...
We'll know.
Whatever that movement is you have.
And I'm make her a vice chair, and she's taking over.
See? That's right. I'm glad you're doing it. I appreciate it.
Take my power where I can.
That's right.
So, and I have to say, just as an aside, I'm happy to be sitting next to Representative Parrish, but I really miss Representative Huffman. Oh, a little back and forth we have had. So we'll have to send you notes.
I was going to say it'll be a notes back and forth.
Yeah, we'll do notes. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm Representative John Lively. I represent House District 12, which is the city of Springfield. My district is entirely within the city of Springfield. I served in the Army from 1968 to 1971, but I come from a family. All of my uncles were in World War II. My dad, who's 90, is a World War II veteran. My brother was served in the Marines, and I don't hold that against him either, but he did. And so, again, these are issues that I am very interested in, and I thank the speaker for this opportunity to be chair, and we'll try to help work with this group to do good work before we're done. So, Brian?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brian Guinea, committee administrator, and this is my first time working with the legislature.
So he gets a new chair, and
we can have some fun with you.
Good luck. So we say yes,
Mr. Chair. One other thing,
certainly.
My wife lost her father, and her father was a World War II veteran. He went and joined the Canadian Air Force before the United States got in the war. Flew in the Canadian Air Force on what they call a Boston bomber. Flew that and got his 25 missions in when the United States came in the war. Got back in the war, they transferred him to the Army Air Corps as a captain, and he ended up becoming the personal pilot of General Doolittle.
Wow.
Lots of stories with that guy.
Yeah.
That's great. And would you like to introduce yourself? Thank you. Thank you for doing this. Okay, so I will close the organizational meeting. We don't have any committee bills today, but as those come up, we'll be... you'll be asked to move those forward. So at this point, I'll open the informational meeting. And our first on our agenda is a presentation about the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and Cameron Smith, Director Smith.
Good
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I am Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I was rushing back from a tribal veteran conference in Lincoln City to come here. And I've now learned not to show up to Indian Country in full suit and tie. And thankfully, they have taken pity on me, given me some gorgeous beadwork with the state of Oregon flag and the U.S. flag and ODVA's logo. And first, for our new members, would like to address the elephant in the room, and no, it is not my baby face as director of ODVA, but rather that Oregon is stuck with a Marine as director of ODVA. Now, my predecessor was a proud Air Force veteran, and he would remind us that Marine stands for muscles are required, intelligence not essential.
We appreciate that information.
Unfortunately, and now Brian Guinea, the staffer, did not introduce himself properly. He is a proud Marine veteran as well. But we have a great team at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and it's my honor to represent and honor our veterans and serve our veterans across the state and to present on our team's work here today. I want to go quickly through our slides. Feel free to interrupt, and then happy to schedule individual meetings with all of you to dig in deeper as well. So amazingly, we are coming into our 70th anniversary this year as a department. So stood up after World War II in 1945, but the first time in our life as an agency that we are serving four generations across five major wars. One out of every 10 Oregonians is a veteran. We have over 320,000 veterans across the state. And just an amazing diversity from every era. So we lumped together that World War II and Korea era, given how closely they served at the end of the mid-40s and early 50s. So four generations, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, still 37% of our veterans population. We hear a lot about Iraq and Afghanistan, but still a relatively small portion. And still all those who served in between in peacetime on humanitarian missions, both here at home and overseas. And really a great diversity, both across the population, urban, rural, male, female, every ethnicity and creed under the sun. 9% fastest growing demographic for women veterans, 8% minorities. For our tribal vets, 1%, but serve at a higher level per capita than any other group. And that diverse group then has issues, just like all of our citizens and their families, across health and wellness, economic opportunity, employment, education, housing, disability compensation and pension from impacts from their service, and then crisis services, whether emergency services as well. So our big challenge is that only 3 out of 10 Oregon veterans have accessed their federal benefits. This is about on par with what we see state by state, but it's a low percentage. And these are largely federal benefits that we're talking about, but also state benefits and other community partners. So a big opportunity for us, not only to help our veterans and their families thrive, but this is a force multiplier in terms of economic infusion back into both our metro areas and our in rural Oregon. So we have two numbers here across the chart. The total federal VA dollars in impact and spending in Oregon, $2.2 billion in that blue bar for 2013 dollars. And during this session, we'll likely be getting 2014 numbers from the Fed VA that we'll update you all on. If you look back even just a decade to that red bar, 2003, it would have been about half, just under $1 billion of Fed VA impact in spending in Oregon. So a huge infusion from the federal VA over the last decade. And that is divvied up. 2.2 is almost incomprehensible, but it's divided up across compensation and pension for disability and low-income pension for veterans, health care benefits, and then also education benefits in terms of GI Bill, Voc Rehab, and other efforts. But that $1.1 billion of Comp and Pen is simply cold, hard cash that flows back into the economy, into the veterans' wallets and bank accounts, and is spent in our community. So a huge infusion back into Oregon. Breaking that $1.1 billion of cash, it works out to be about $92 million every month of disability and disability compensation and pension flowing back to Oregon for roughly a little over 60,000 disabled veterans in 2013. Annual average per veteran would be about 14,000, so it could go sliding scale all the way up to about 36,000 or more. But on average, disabled veterans receive 14,000 across Oregon, and that exceeds the national average of 12,500. Here's a great map that we fed some data into Google. This is our veterans population. So just like all of our citizens, largely they live in counties up and down the I-5 corridor. But what's fascinating, while you may only have 200 to 1,000 vets living in Lake County or Harney or a little more in Malheur, but it's a much smaller population based in those rural counties. So the veterans will make up a quarter to a third of those rural counties. So significant attention in rural Oregon, but also up and down the I-5 Valley just based on population. So and similarly, this is the total comp and pen number, that 2013 $1.1 billion and how it's distributed out. Not surprising that, again, the heavily populated counties are drawing the largest chunk of that. But what's fascinating is that in rural Oregon, so this is when we divide those county comp and pen numbers by the number of veterans they have, it's really in rural Oregon that they are bringing home more of those VA dollars per veteran than anywhere else. If we could get these same kind of numbers in rural Oregon in those metro areas, it would be a huge force multiplier. We have statewide comp and pen average is about $3,400 per veteran. And that puts us in a top 10 in terms of veteran services. When we compare that statewide number to other states, we are a top 10 state in drawing down those resources, but that is still only off of tapping three of every 10 Oregon veterans. And that is our big opportunity and our big challenge, to figure out ways to increase that, not just to bring down more of those Fed VA dollars and our fair share as a state, but also to reduce what is on general fund state safety net services often. And we have at the end of the slides the actual data county by county that you can look at for the comp and pen at the end for your individual counties. And we like to think that why are we in that top 10 of drawing down those Fed VA resources? Largely it is because we have had that state and county partnership across veteran service offices since 1945. And this, we didn't want to miss our celebratory year and date, so we were digging out the original statutes for the department and signed by the governor in March, effective I think of June or July of 1945, pulled up old yellowing newspaper articles, and it literally was county veteran service offices and the state figuring out what their shared role was in helping support our World War II veterans and their families as they returned home from that greatest generation. So other states look at this and are envious of the veteran service offices that we have. So 34 counties across the state have offices that really provides that statewide reach and statewide advocacy. Also on this slide, you have the rough regional population numbers, so 116,000 in Portland Metro. But still a good chunk in Central Oregon of almost 20,000. We always call out Southern Oregon is surprisingly, given some of the population scales, but 42,000 in Southern Oregon is just a huge chunk of veterans, and also over on even more when you consider onto the coast of the Banana Belt with a lot of the retirees, and also a lot of hinging off of the federal VA facility at the medical center in Roseburg. So I took over March of 2013 as director, and just over the last, coming up on 2 years now, over the last 2 years, we've had significant turnover on our team, probably about 40%, both across our management team and staff, simply being an older tenured agency with a lot of folks at the right time to go forth and conquer in new opportunities. And we have dug in trying to capture their expertise as they leave the building and capture the heart and soul of our organization, but then also bring fresh eyes to our work. So we have built this as a strategic framework, but both given that breadth of the number of veterans and the diversity of issues they face, it's a fascinating challenge to figure out how does an organization of 80 FTE try to organize itself to truly create some leverage and drive some opportunities. If we looked back, so our vision, we want veterans and their families to thrive in Oregon. More targeted, our mission, ODVA serves and honors veterans through our leadership, our advocacy, and our strong partnerships, and then our core values of respect, integrity, stewardship, and excellence. If we looked back at previous strategic plans, they would have largely been focused for the agency just on our core programs that we'll talk about in a little bit, the home loan program, our veterans' homes, the claims and counseling. Those are all strong efforts that we have to continue to drive, But veterans are not going to thrive in Oregon simply because of the programs at ODVA. Our biggest leverage point will be that inverted pyramid of the federal VA, $160 billion annual budget at the federal VA level, on down through the state to that pointy tip of the spear of the county VSOs, finding ways to leverage that and target veteran services to serve more veterans and serve them better is our largest opportunity. Even when we maximize those Fed VA dollars, we know it's going to be broader partnerships, so mobilizing partnerships to leverage all resources available to veterans. It's going to be the community colleges, the universities, the faith-based, the employers, the private sector, nonprofit partners, finding ways. It's not a core programmatic effort, but finding ways to infuse that into our programs and our efforts. And then lastly, we always say for drive veteran engagement, it is not a shortage of resources always. There are more resources for veterans and military families, but often a challenge of who are the veterans, what are the resources, and connecting the two. And that's a challenge we see both across human services in general and specifically for veterans. And then lastly, if we don't do our core operations well, if we don't have the best in operations at our Oregon Veterans Home, the skilled nursing, the best home loan program, that we won't have that opportunity to be the leader, advocate, or partner in the other areas. And I won't go strategy by strategy in the interest of time, but for any of the new members or previous members, happy to sit down and go through the strategic framework further. I would just say this is almost laughably high level in terms of a strategic framework. So we're turning now as a team. A lot of change over the last 2 years. This has helped guide our budget proposals for the governor's budget and what we'll be advocating through Ways and Means, and a few targeted policy choices coming through both Senate and House vets. But we'll drive down through each of these strategies and begin to flesh them out. You know, one of them for target veteran services, invest in a 21st century veteran services system to make sure we have a true seamless electric claim submission process from the counties through us up to the feds. That has its own different levels of strategies and sub-tier strategies underneath that we'll continue to flesh out. So just to touch briefly on our core veteran programs, going back to that 1945 when we first stood up, it was the home loan program, both on home and farm loans for returning GIs out of World War II. We now, what we're calling, what we have historically labeled veterans homes, now we're calling aging veteran services as we stand up two facilities, and then also statewide veteran services, which is that claims and counseling function. Here are the rough numbers for the governor's recommended budget. The gray is other funds, and then the orange is in the general fund. So about $15 million across the two-year budget for the home loan program. Aging Veteran Services seeing a significant increase to $65.6 million as we bring on that second veterans home in Lebanon, and then requesting $11.5 million in general fund for statewide veteran services, about half of which flows down to the counties for that statewide network. So then also kind of the support services that we have at ODVA, our communications and IT, the finance and budget, the administration, facility and construction management, and then HR. What's important to note is that $15 million on the home loan program isn't all just home loan efforts, but is helping support across, it supports the infrastructure of the department across the broader swath. And then general fund is strictly limited to those, both down to the county and for statewide veteran services. So the home loan program, we were the big bank of ODVA, the largest loan, the largest loans, even compared to the private sector back in the day. Billions of dollars have lent over these past 70 years. Due to demographic changes, as you lose that huge swath of World War II and Korea, as Vietnam veterans age, just different market realities in terms of for returning service members now. Going from hundreds of thousands of loans on the books, now about 2,000 loans on the books for a total loan portfolio of over $200 million. If you looked back and just in the last year for 2014, $58 million lent. We take tax advantage bonds from the feds and able to give a low interest loan, a low interest rate, below market rate interest rate to our veterans compared to the Fed VA loan, which is kind of a loan guarantee, often for a zero down payment. The sweet spot for us is in that low interest rate. We service all the loans in our portfolio, so we don't sell them off to another servicer, which is both a huge value to give that quality of service over the life of a loan, but also make sure that we are giving quality loans because we're going to live with these in our portfolio. And then also enables us that we were thankful, especially in the depths of the housing in the Great Recession. You see our delinquency rate and foreclosure only 1.45%, and we literally have the flexibility to jump through hoops to make sure that we can keep our veterans in their home. It's not simply a business for us. I would note that we do have some funding limitations. The qualified veteran mortgage bonds that we use have all kinds of federal tax law implications. It can only be used from data service for 25 years, and now we have constitutionally in Oregon, I forget which year it was, maybe 2011 or 2010, we made that a lifetime benefit, and through our finance team and our advisors, we've been able to keep rolling forward our most flexible bond source to be able to still lend to Vietnam vets, which are probably about half the loans we made in the last year, so a big chunk of our portfolio. But we don't have that sustainable funding source. It would be limited to 25 years out of the main funding source of QVMB bonds. So looking to try to see if there's other sources of funds and or try to get that one little line of IRS tax law changed at the federal level. I think that's all I have. Any questions on the home loan program before I keep pressing?
So, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Sal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we discussed quite some time ago, I believe before you even arrived, about doing a mirror of the federal VA system with a zero down and utilizing this also as a refi. And you said, and I think Director Willis said that had to get some things squared away with the feds, but it would also open up our home loan program to be more active and more self-sustaining. How are we progressing with that?
So, Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Esquivel, I would say slowly. We would love to be able to offer more loan products. You know, a zero down combined with our low interest rate would be the holy grail to drive traffic our way. It has quite a bit of regulatory and staffing impacts in the short term to bring on the zero down concept and qualify under the federal VA program. Still something that we're going to look at and explore. On the refi, so qualified veteran mortgage bonds, again, one of their limitations, you can't use them for refinance. So a lot of the business that was coming our way, we weren't able to offer that. And we've been hesitant for the small pots that we have in terms of flexibility. We've been hesitant to tap. We have authority to do a refi product and offer that through those flexible funds or would have that flexibility to do it. But it would go so quickly that it would be just such a limited benefit very quickly and we'd lose those reserves. I'm less hopeful that we can get the federal tax law changed to open. I'm hopeful that we can get the 25-year limitation removed. Less hopeful on the refi given competition just across the financial industry and banks in general. So I think if we were able to move to refi, we'd have to find some ongoing sustainable pot of funds that we could tap on an ongoing basis, because there would be significant demand both across in our own portfolio and for vets that are with other banks right now looking to refi.
Sure, go ahead.
Now, I don't understand, I guess, the federal approach on this, because aren't you always a veteran? Why do you have 25-year limitation for your benefit when you earn that? And I mean, we earn our benefit. Is there any reasoning for that? Or is it just because somebody thought that'd be a good idea?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Esquivel, I don't know the full history on it, but in different negotiations, it used to be a 30-year limitation. It got dialed back. We sometimes were able to broaden the cap in terms of how much bonds we could have. A lot of it comes down to financial impacts. But clearly the Oregon citizens, both this legislature, the governor, and the citizens have said they want this to be a lifetime benefit, not just for returning soldiers for 25 years, but as a lifetime benefit. And then we've also now you can have four loans up to 417, only one at a time, but now it can be used multiple times throughout a veteran's life. So finding that flexibility in our program to match the intent of the Oregon citizens is a big push.
Follow up. So now what you're saying is you can have four loans. It used to be when you used it one time, you lost it, mm-hmm. It was done. Now, what about those people that lost it and it's mm-hmm. done? Do they come back into the picture as an ongoing benefit? Because to me,
that should be something. If it's $450,000 or whatever it is, then whatever they used back in 1968 or whatever, 1980, that should be deducted out of the total, and they should have that much reserve left.
So, Chair,
is that the way it's working?
Representative Esquil, my understanding is they would be eligible for another loan up to the 417 limit.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Lively, Representative Esquivel, members of the committee, in the blue folders passing around, actually there is a legislative concept to work with credit unions to allow more capital to be used for the refinance authority that the department has.
Hadn't got to us yet.
Just saying. That it's one of those things that has been identified over the years that could be a real assistance, especially for folks that are reintegrating after a deployment that already have an existing loan but have had some challenges while they're gone and need to refi. Mm-hmm. Currently in discussion with the credit unions about providing a methodology that's good for them but still retains control for ODVA to do exactly what they do best, keep the note, be able to work with the vets to keep them in their homes. Mm-hmm. So certainly would appreciate your support on that particular measure.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, again, just want to emphasize this is both a benefit to the veteran and their family, but a significant way it has helped build the department that we have in terms of the physical building. We used to be 600 strong, kind of the DHS of veterans across the state, largely with loan offices around the state. And that has generated reserves over the 70 years, and we're slowly chipping away at those reserves right now, funding the rest of the department off of other funds up from the loan program. So both trying to reinvigorate the home program as a benefit and as a funding source, and then also reduce longer term our core services to make sure they're not funded solely off of the loan program.
So, Director Smith, I just have a question about the program. So in the early, I know when I first got a veterans loan, part of the whole advantage was the interest rate difference. But given where home interest rates are today, is there still a competitive or a difference between what the VA, what your loan can be and what they
are? Chair Lively, members of the committee, were you actually in the program?
Yes, I was.
I'm 4.9% hoping we didn't foreclose on our new chair ever. So yes, it has been a challenge. We have always been able to offer a below market interest rate, yeah, even in the low interest rate environments that we've seen. That's both a challenge in terms of the income that we're able to generate off of the loans, but also in terms of the reserves that we have, they bring in less, just like everyone's sure checking account brings in less. So rising interest rates is not necessarily a bad opportunity for us, mm-hmm, but one of the ways we've been successful is in by hedging and using variable rate interest rates. So we're kind of shifting back to a fixed rate environment, trying to lock in some of those long-term rates on our bonding to make sure that it is the financial wizardry for our bond folks and our finance team and advisors that have made us be able to offer that competitive interest rate in difficult times.
Great. Thank you.
Aging Veteran Services. So we are very proud of our skilled nursing facility that stood up in the late 90s out in the Dalles, the Oregon Veterans Home, and now bringing on our second facility, the Lebanon Veterans Home, here in the Mid-Willamette Valley. We're looking at shifting. Conservatorship has historically, 147 conservatorship clients that we help represent. These are folks, some of the most vulnerable veterans that aren't able to manage their estates or finances. Through the judicial court process, they are referred to us to help manage that for them. Given the age of that demographic and some of the expertise of folks we have coming on as staff, looking to shift the conservatorship program under Aging Veteran Services. And then just to emphasize, when we go back to that slide of the diversity of our veterans, for World War II, Korean, Vietnam, it's 52.2% of our veterans are age 60 to 100 years old. And what we're trying to do, so our two state veterans homes, the one in the Dalles just recently won a Gold Award, national recognition from the healthcare associations for the quality of the care. The new facility in Lebanon is built around the small home model, so less of the institutional wing and more pod-like structures. Single bedrooms. Literally, I think it's the best facility from a facility standpoint, and then it's going to be matched by the staff and the residents that live there. We contract out day-to-day management of the facilities, and it's through the Veterans Care Centers of Oregon and WestCare, a professional management company. We get great results out of it. It is both, a below market rate. So you look at the average across Oregon, $256 a day for skilled nursing, and we are at $158 per day. And that is really a mix of Medicaid, Medicare, Fed VA per diems, and also private pay as well. These facilities are built out with 65% federal construction dollars and roughly 35% for a local match. What makes it pencil out long term, so no general fund going into these facilities, what makes it pencil out is both those diversity of the funding streams, but then also a high occupancy rate. So if you look across skilled nursing in Oregon, a lot of facilities are at 60 or 70% occupancy. For 2013, we were at 92% occupancy in the Dalles, which contributes to be able to provide that quality of care without a general fund infusion. Makes us the envy of other veterans' homes across the nation. It's going to be interesting as we opened the Lebanon Veterans Home October, dedicated in September, opened in October, just to private pay residents until we got that Medicaid and Medicare certification. We'll ramp up there's about 14 residents right now. We just got that Medicaid, Medicare certification. We'll probably ramp up to about 20 residents, and then you go for the federal VA survey, or they come in for their approval to make sure that we can then have per diem going forward. Then we'll truly begin to ramp up, and these are kind of pod-like A, B, Charlie, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie wing, or pods, and we'll open those up as we stand up both higher quality staff and begin to phase in residents. But a lot of demand that we're seeing for in the Mid-Willamette Valley, given that population center we've seen and just a lot of aging vets. But the challenge will be to make sure that both of our facilities are penciling out financially, that we haven't dropped census in the Dalles as we stood up our second one before moving forward with any other future concepts. Any questions on our skilled nursing?
Good, thank you.
And so for the meat and potatoes, states have apples and oranges across their state departments of Veterans Affairs, but everyone has that advocacy mission, claims and counseling, in terms of trying to help our veterans and their families navigate the challenging bureaucracy of FedVA disability compensation, pension, and also on health care. So we have 55 county VSOs across 34 counties, a small chunk of VSOs at the statewide level, both in Salem and Portland. Again, half of our general fund passes through to the counties, and we've really tried to delineate what's a county VSO role versus what's a state role. So we are re-emphasizing at the statewide level for veteran services that training and certification component, the claims review as these claims come up from the boots on the ground or the county VSOs, not just making sure the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, but looking at the quality of the claim so that we aren't contributing to the backlog of the claims simply on bad product going up, that we are putting the best claim work forward. And then we also do appeals through our Portland Claims Office. So when a disability claim decision is denied, often harder for our rural counties to get to the hearings, and we're able to help represent on appeals through what is a whole court system, very similar to Social Security Administration, a whole veteran court system on disability compensation and pension. So we actually take on power of attorney for and represent 86,000 veterans. That was as of April 2014. For 2014, we had over 8,000 new power of attorneys and over 9,000 claims. We were re-emphasizing that training and certification. We came to the e-board last year and doubled our capacity to two now that are taken care of. It's still a drop in the bucket, but getting us in the hunt in terms of making sure as folks turn over that we're there to help bring them up to speed. It's about $3.5 million in the current biennium that we passed down to the counties, and an additional $1 million outreach grant, Veterans Extended Outreach Grant. Kind of goes to that drive veteran engagement, not always a lack of resources, but a lack of awareness, making sure we're reaching both the young folks coming back, their families, all the way through Vietnam and World War II. These folks are often riding a desk, submitting those power of attorney claims, but they're also that center of gravity in the community, linking to diverse partners. They're really the belly button in the community. And that's just a graphic representation there of folks submitting through the county VSO up through us, and we train and certify those county VSOs, and then on up to the federal VA for decision. So happy to take any questions either on our framework or our core services. And then at the end, you'll also see some of your counties called out in terms of both those urban, in an urban county, this is over $100 million impact in a Lane or a Multnomah. But even in a Douglas County, I think it's $80 million plus. And then even in our rural county, still a significant infusion of these comp and pen dollars going back into the counties. But happy to take any questions.
So questions, Madam Chair? So I have a question dealing with the 3 out of 10. So do we have some sense that 3 out of 10, the types of things or the types of needs they have that aren't being addressed some other way in our communities, since they're not necessarily taking advantage or avail themselves of the veteran services?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, so that 3 in 10 number, it's always a hard one to pin down, even off of federal VA data, but that is the best number that we can get from an ongoing that they're engaged with the Fed VA system. There may have been someone that had a home loan earlier, but then hasn't since re-engaged with any benefits, or if they, you know, home loan or GI Bill and then haven't engaged. The 3 in 10 is largely off of roughly 90,000 veterans accessing Fed VA health care, both at the major medical centers, whether Portland VA, Roseburg, we feed into Walla Walla and Boise, plus the smaller clinics around the state. But in terms of gaps and needs of services, you know, it's going to be what all of our citizens face. We are not going to solve the issues that our veterans and militaries face solely, even with a $160 billion Fed VA system. The challenges across suicide, we're about, you know, 9%, 10% of the population in Oregon, but 25% of all suicides, you know, homelessness issues, addictions, mental health, any of the challenging societal issues we'll see for our veterans population. But what's important for us, we feel like it's not always going to be the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs direct programs that solve it, but we're trying to position ourselves as the leader and advocate, both to shape the Fed VA system and to bring our military lens to a lot of the other state agencies and community partners that are driving that success.
But if we're successful moving it from 3 out of 10 to that we're covering more, as I've read and heard about the federal VA system, the shortage of physicians and that, so isn't there potentially a problem there anyway from the standpoint, even if we're able to get more people access, that the access won't necessarily be what's needed at that particular moment just because of the limitations?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, whether that's in rural Oregon and a mental health specialist, we see that for all citizens, including veterans. Fed VA has a challenge competing. As we reboot healthcare more generally across the nation and in Oregon, there will be some interesting tensions. Do you have more of a community care model longer term come out of Fed VA healthcare? There are significant challenges in terms of transportation to get veterans to the specific Fed VA healthcare. So the models are beginning to change, but I would say a lot of Vietnam veterans or earlier that grew up with a Fed VA healthcare still, you know, we get great results. Access has been a challenge, and we've seen it out of the firestorm politically last summer. Mm-hmm. It is a great system of care, but the models are beginning to change.
Chair Lively,
yeah. Representative Evans.
Director Smith, members of the committee, on that particular issue also, 2 points are interesting. Number one, U.S. government used to include the questions about veteran, not veteran on census. They dropped that. So trying to figure out exactly where veterans are became a little bit harder thanks to the federal government. Mm-hmm. Second piece is it's a chicken and an egg kind of thing, in that the formulas that many of the formulas that the USVA has are based on folks that are eligible requesting the benefits the way that they have to do that. If they're not in the system, then they don't have to gear up for the system. So outreach is really the most important investment we can make across the spectrum so that we can showcase the need for the feds to have to pay.
Sure. Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much for coming. We look forward to working with you. Okay, so next we have a presentation on the Oregon Military Department. Here is Major General Daniel Hokanson, Adjutant General, and David Stuckey, Deputy Director. And if you'll all, gentlemen, will all introduce yourselves.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Boone, Vice Chair Esquivel, Representative Evans, Representative Parrish, Representative Peluso, Representative Huffman. I'd like to, for the record, my name is Dan Hokanson. I'm the Adjutant General for the State of Oregon. With me today is Command Sergeant Major Shane Lake, the Senior Enlisted Leader for the Oregon National Guard, and Sean McCormick from our Office of Emergency Management.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to give your committee an overview of the Oregon Military Department. I would ask at any time if you have any questions to please let us know, and I look forward to any follow-up now or in the future that you'd like to with respect to our agency. Before I begin, I'd like to highlight two of the outstanding Oregon National Guard members of your Oregon National Guard. To the left, on the far right side, right next to the NATO four-star general, is Lieutenant Colonel Mike Burkhart. Mike graduated from Western Oregon State College, and he served on active duty before joining the Oregon National Guard. He's the energy manager at Georgia Pacific's Wanna Mill and assists with coaching basketball, baseball, and football in Clatskanie. In November, on about 1 week's notice, our forward commander for 2nd Battalion 162nd Infantry had to be medevaced out of country. I gave Mike a phone call, and within 3 weeks of that phone call, he was in Afghanistan and commanding nearly 400 Oregon National Guard soldiers, and he's done an exceptional job from the time he hit the ground and continue to get great reports from him and what his soldiers are doing. On the right side is one of our Air National Guard members, Staff Sergeant Derek Yeager. Similar to Mike Burkhart, we got a short notice request for someone from the Air National Guard with a very specific skill set. His ability to look at airfields throughout Central Command, which is primarily the Middle East. They needed to replace a soldier that had to be sent home. So Derek volunteered, and less than 7 days from notification, he was in theater. And so they're both downrange right now. For Derek, this is his second deployment with the Oregon Air National Guard and his sixth deployment since 9/11. So just some outstanding Oregonians volunteering on short notice. Okay, next slide, please. Today I'll begin by reviewing our mission, vision, and priorities, cover our new organizational structure, review our dual missions, how we support both our state and nation, our current operational deployments, where we're located around the state, highlight our strength and assets, our economic contribution to the state, review the Office of Emergency Management and our Youth Challenge Program, and end with just a brief review of some of our proposed legislation. Next slide. And the mission and vision here were developed as part of our strategic planning system that I started shortly after becoming the Adjutant General. And our basically strategic planning system is composed of three documents. And I'm a short as much as I can. So our first one was one page. And that sets the, it's called our strategic letter, establishes our vision, mission, and priorities. The second is the strategic direction to the Oregon Military Department, which provides greater detail to the strategic letter's priorities by identifying our key efforts. And the third document is the Oregon Military Department strategic plan, which builds on both of those previous documents, reconciles ends, ways, and means, and establishes measurable metrics to meet our goals and objectives for the next 5 years. Both the strategic letter and our strategic direction of the Oregon Military Department have been completed and published, and we're on the final draft of our strategic plan, which will be published later this spring. Okay. And as you see, these were both developed early on in the organization. Next slide. The four priorities highlighted on this slide were also developed as part of our strategic letter. And as you can see, they are to provide trained and ready operational forces, not only for our state, but for our federal government or the nation. Be effective stewards of our resources, sustain the Oregon Military Department community. These are not only our soldiers and family members, but veterans as well. And then also to forge and maintain partnerships, particularly here within the state, but also outside the state on those agencies that could influence our future. Next slide, please. And I apologize right up front. This is one of those dizzying slides. But for those that are not familiar with the military department, shortly after I arrived, I tried to restructure it, and we're in the process of restructuring. It's a year-long process so that we are a flatter organization and more responsive not only to the needs of our state but our nation. And so basically just going from left to right, if you look at the five main columns, each one is headed by a one-star general, or on the far right in terms of interagency is Mr. Dave Stuckey. Now, each of them are part-time, as are their senior enlisted leader. And so within our organization, we keep one full-time colonel equivalent that runs the organization day-to-day. On the far left, it says ATAG for support, which is our assistant adjutant general, and he runs all the support across the entire state. The one to the right of that is ATAG for operations, And there's a program called the Dual Status Commander where we train general officers in case there is a significant disaster in the state, that if active duty military forces enter the state, they fall under command of the National Guard officer. And I was fortunate to work at Northern Command when this concept was developed and taught some of the first classes. But the intent is our National Guard officers are very familiar with our state and the disasters that we come across year to year, sometimes over time. But the intent is when we bring active duty forces in, they may not be familiar with the state at all, may have never been here. And so what we do is we have them fall under the command of our National Guard officers, so we utilize their resources the best way possible. And so what we did by this is we actually developed a team that on their drill weekends, the one weekend a month and 2 weeks out of the year, they rehearse how we would respond to any of our natural disasters we face here in the state. Primarily the Cascade is one of our biggest ones lately. So in the event there's a disaster, they would stand up, have already practiced it, and can get to work right away. And then moving, continuing to the right, the blue, of course, our Air Force, and I won't say anything bad about the Air Force, great organization, and that maintains all Air Forces fall under the Air Component Commander. And to the right is green, which I'm partial to, and that is the Army or the Land Component Commander, and all the Army or Forces fall under them. And then to the far right is our interagency, and this is where the Office of Emergency Management, our Youth Challenge, and our state installations fall under. So these are primarily all of the civilians that work in our agency.
So I have a question, and you may get to this. So you talked about the authority, so if there were a disaster, the officers here would be in command, and even if others from out of the state came in, they'd fall under that command. So what about within the state other jurisdictions? And I'm thinking about the state police or the local jurisdiction. So if we have a state disaster, and we have your group that's responded, do those organizations in that, in theory, fall underneath that structure too?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, one rule that we try to make sure we relate to everyone is the National Guard is only in support of whoever the lead agency is. Okay. So within the state, the governor would appoint the lead agency, and we are there just to support them in every way we can.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir. Okay. Next slide. This slide kind of highlights what we try to do is show the fact that we utilize our military equipment. We call it a dual-use capability. So on the top right picture, that's our federal role, and these are our folks actually downrange in combat operations providing medical evacuation support. The great thing is that we also can utilize that capability here within the state. From 2002 to 2005, I was fortunate to run this actual organization, and what we had is 12 of the most state-of-the-art rescue helicopters sitting on the ramp in Salem. So we worked with all the county sheriff's organizations to respond, and what we found is the training that our pilots and air crew members received responding no notice anywhere in Oregon made them extremely proficient when they deployed overseas. Mm-hmm. In fact, our medevac unit at one time was rated the best medevac unit in the entire U.S. military. That just stands with the level of training that they get at home and how they take that downrange with them. Next slide, please. We also have dual missions for all of our forces, and these pictures were both taken this year. Currently, we have soldiers just over 1,000 deployed into Afghanistan. Roughly one-tenth of all U.S. military in Afghanistan is from the state of Oregon and the Oregon National Guard. And then, of course, as recently as this summer, excuse me, our helicopters provided firefighting support throughout the state in one of our worst fire seasons. Next slide. On the Air National Guard side, this is a very unique thing that most folks are not aware of. But 24/7, 365, we provide the air control alert mission for the entire Pacific Northwest. So the upper right photo, that's actually a Russian Bear bomber, one of two. That photo was taken by one of our pilots off the Oregon coast this summer. That's the second time that's occurred in the last 3 years, on the 4th of July in 2012 and June of this year. So as things develop around the world, we do have a significant impact here in Oregon. And if you look at the lower left, this is our, it's called a SURF-P. It's basically the CBURN stands for chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, or explosive. And this is a team that we have within the Oregon National Guard, and they train for any potential disasters in the state to involve chemicals or any type of event that may cause them to be called out. And they have doctors assigned to them. They also have technical rescue personnel so they can actually go into collapsed buildings and rescue people as well. Okay. Next slide. I wanted to show you this slide, sir, just as a an overview to show you how busy our folks are. You know, they talk about 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks out of the year. We're still looking for that person, but that's all they do. If you look, we tried to just really look at after 9/11 to account for that. On the left is the number of personnel that we've activated for events within the state, and to the right are our federal events. And it's a little bit misleading. You look at 20,011. But in 2009 alone, we had 5,500 mobilized. That rolled well into 2010 as well, so that a lot of these times overlapped. And the one thing that we're trying to highlight everywhere we go is on this day, we have 1,018 Oregonians deployed in support of combat operations in the Middle East, not only Afghanistan, but Kuwait and in Iraq. Next slide. And this is a picture that I get every morning. And it shows around the world where all of our soldiers and airmen are currently deployed. So you obviously see the large formations in Afghanistan and Kuwait. But in case you weren't aware, we have a state partnership with the country of Vietnam and Bangladesh. And we actually have an officer from the Oregon National Guard that works full-time in the embassy in Vietnam and also in Bangladesh. And they coordinate not only for our visits, but also to help support the entire country of the United States in their interaction with those countries. Okay. Next slide. And so this is a overview to show you where we're located around the state of Oregon. We have 6 major training facilities, 2 air bases, and 36 armories across the state. On the Army side, we have just over now currently 6,000 soldiers. We're authorized over 6,400. The 2 major formations are 2 Army brigades, an 82nd Brigade, and then the 41st Infantry Brigade Combat Team. And for those that have relatives from World War II, this is the descendants from the 41st Infantry Division that fought throughout the South Pacific in World War II. And then we have a small collection of other units. What I'd like to highlight on the lower left, the 104th Civil Support Team. This is a unit that is on call 24/7 with a 90-minute response time, and they have a very unique and very expensive capability to go anywhere and determine what any substance is. And so if there's any concern about white powder, these are the folks that actually show up and have the analytical tools to tell you exactly what it is. And they support almost all of our law enforcement agencies throughout the state on a regular basis. Okay. Next slide. And this is some of the equipment. The Army, we like to count vehicles and stuff like that. The key ones here to highlight within the state is our heavy tactical trucks, our Humvees, our light tactical vehicles, and our medium tactical vehicles, and our engineering equipment like bulldozer excavators. These are very high dual use. Not only do you use them for a military mission, but in the case of any disasters in the state, they're the best equipment that we can get. And of course, the helicopters we utilize year-round, not only for firefighting and for medical evacuation, but also in support of law enforcement. And sometimes we actually rotate down for the southwest border as well. Okay. Next slide. On the Air National Guard, a little bit smaller, about 2,200. We have 2 fighter wings, and we are one of the only states in the entire nation that has 2 fighter wings. In fact, 40% of the Air Force's F-15s in America are in Oregon, which is pretty amazing. It's one of those things that most folks don't realize. Also, we have a combat operations group that handles a couple of smaller units. One thing I would highlight there is our 125th Special Tactics Squadron. These are the Air Force's equivalent of special operations folks. Last year, we actually awarded one of them the 3rd highest honor for valor, the Silver Star, based on the combat operations they conducted in Afghanistan. Very highly trained, outstanding capability, not only overseas, but also here within the state. Next slide. As I mentioned, 40% of the F-15s. We've got 21 F-15s up at Portland, And there's a dual mission there. We have two aircraft that are always on alert, that are usually within the air less than 15 minutes from the first call. And if they're alerted, they can be up much faster. We also have a worldwide deployable mission. And if you look around the world, what's going on right now, particularly in the Ukraine, there's a high probability that we may be deploying some of our aircraft to Europe on a rotational basis. We're waiting to hear a decision from the Air Force in the near future. In Kingsley, if you've ever been down to Kingsley Field, and if you have not, please let us know. We'd love to get you down there. We train all F-15 pilots for the United States Air Force, with the exception for the Strike Eagles down in Kingsley Field. And so that's active duty, Air Force Reserve, and Air National Guard. It's quite an operation, outstanding capability, and we are the third largest employer in that region as a result. Next slide. And, one thing I just wanted to highlight, when we talk about the air control alert mission, these are the air control alert stations across the United States. We have a total of 16. The key one there is, if you look at Portland, there's really not anyone else there. And if we go to the next slide, this shows the flight time requirements from the next closest regions. So we are absolutely critical to the air defense of the Pacific Northwest of the United States. We have units up in Elmendorf, Alaska, but that alone, it's over 2.5 hours to get here. So our crews are responsible, as I mentioned before, 24/7 for the air defense of the Pacific Northwest. Next slide. I did want to touch briefly on our budget, because a large portion, roughly 93% of our budget, comes from the federal government, and it's depicted here. And if we go to the next slide, it actually kind of shows the detail. The highlight I like to show there is, of the $400 million that we bring in, 93% from the federal government, $286 million of that actually goes into payroll for our soldiers and airmen throughout the state. So if you look at the state of investment, or the state's investment of about $28 million, it's literally 10 times that we bring back to the state in payroll. Transitioning to a couple of our other agencies, the Office of Emergency Management, we just hired a new director. Andrew Phelps is coming to us from New Mexico. He's the emergency manager for the city of Santa Fe. He'll take over on the 17th of April. I'm sorry, the 17th of February. And one thing I would like to highlight, one of the things that we worked on very hard since my arrival, is the Cascadia playbook you'll see in the lower left-hand corner. And what this is it's, for lack of a better term, it's a checklist on what we would do for our senior leaders within the state if there, heaven forbid, there'd be a Cascadia event. And we actually met with the Department of Justice earlier today to work with them on their portion of this. So we released that. You'll see from the governor's picture there. He released that this summer. It's in effect right now. We have copies with all of the key leaders within the state government, and also the folks that we're going to be charged to ask to help respond to that. And if any of you'd like a more detailed brief, I'd love to sit down with you. A lot of great work has gone into that. We were the first state in the nation to develop this, and this actually goes back to a conversation that we had about 3 years ago on the potential of developing this. And my hat's off to Office of Emergency Management for really getting the coordination legwork done to get that completed. Okay, next slide. One other thing I'd like to highlight, and if you haven't been there, this is an absolutely great news story, our Youth Challenge program that we have just outside of Bend. This takes students that have either dropped out of high school or have really no hope to graduate, and we bring them into a military camp style. It's a six-month program. We run it twice a year. We shoot for about 250 graduates per year, and it brings them in. It's a certified education program with the local high schools, and it really turns these kids around. If you go to one of their graduations, you will come out feeling extremely happy with the great product that they produce. It's been ranked the best program in the nation so many times they kind of stopped awarding it to us. We've got some great folks out there. It's been around since 1994, and the support that we get from the legislature makes this stuff continue. And it's just a fantastic I cannot say enough about it. And when you see the kids that graduate and their families and how they turn their lives around, it's a great opportunity for us to be part of the community. Okay, and I believe this is our last slide. I just wanted to touch briefly on some of the proposed legislation that we have coming forward. The first one, House Bill 2426, our current 911 system needs to be updated from analog under new relay framework. And so this just allows us to modernize and increase and add new technology. The second one has been an issue brought up with the city of Portland, so we're trying to make this a nationwide for emergency responders and emergency management, whether or not they can utilize lights on their vehicles. The third one, House Bill 2428, this is more of a housekeeping. If we mobilize folks, it's currently under OEM, but we prefer to put that under OMD, writ large, and then that only takes place when they're actually utilized. And then the last one is on Senate Bill 235. It's administrative name changes. FEMA has changed some of the terminology, so we want to make sure that our terminology is correct with theirs, especially as we apply for grants. It makes that grant process a little bit easier for us. Okay. Chair Lively, members of the committee, we're open to any questions you have at this time.
Questions? Representative
Chair Lively, General Hokanson, I have about 9 questions, so
we'll
go one by one, if that's acceptable.
Right.
How many troops are downrange is the first question I have.
Okay. Chair Lively, members of the committee, representatives, we have 1,018 currently deployed downrange.
Okay. And I want to know what happened with the reintegration program.
Okay. Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Evans, at the end of the last year, what we found is our reintegration program has not changed. It's still in effect. We have 48 full-time employees, as well as all our representatives across the state. What did change was a joint transition assistance program that we had funding for. Over the past couple of years, the Department of Defense is getting away from personal services contracts, and we've seen a significant decrease in funding across the board. Within the National Guard, they looked at the funding was over $125 million. They figured they could save $25 million alone by trying to reduce these contracts. So at the end of the last year, our folks had worked together directly with National Guard Bureau to make sure that the new contract actually met the mandated requirements for the personal services contract so that it was not a personal services contract. In the course of that process, it took late. As a result, it was advertised late, but we still had 34, I believe, companies that were authorized to bid for it, and unfortunately, none of them did. Upon completion of that, when that occurred, we notified the governor's staff. I actually went to National Guard Bureau immediately after that to talk to them and find out, how did this occur? How do we get this back? In talking with them, we sat down with them and looked at what we're trying to do is get away from a year-to-year contract, which ends on the 30th of September every year, which is extremely frustrating because it has to be renewed and rewritten every single year. And if the process under which they do change, and what we found is they change, they don't always educate the contracting personnel with the changes. Long story short, where we are now is we actually asked for an independent investigation. They came in, and we met with the folks from National Guard Bureau, and they're still looking at it, but they're almost done. We asked them to help us to write a future contract so that rather than having to re-advertise every year, we could get an option where we could just renew it every year if the funding was available. As recently as earlier this week, we found out that we did get the additional funding back, and what we did in the interim is I took resources that we had internally to the state, and we hired 4 of our employees full-time and put them in the headquarters of the units that are currently deployed so that we can manage them through the end of the fiscal year. We also asked National Guard Bureau Contracting to help us write the future contract for the money that we've just been allocated so that this doesn't happen again.
So we were not the only state in the union to lose the reintegration contract. Is that true?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, our program was unique to Oregon, and so there were multiple contracts that did not continue across the nation. But because ours was so unique, we were one of the few that actually had beyond the yellow ribbon funding, and that's the funding that we just received.
Okay. So, thank you for that. My next question has to do with Oregon Emergency Management. And I've read the audit completed in February of 14, along with your letter, 11 different items to work on. It's your staff's discretion. I'd like to follow up on all 11 and see where we're at. That's more of a question. If we can do that, I'd appreciate it. I don't want to take too much time today on that one, but please know that I'm very keenly interested in the results of that particular audit and our steps forward. Number four.
Well, so, Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Evan, if you go back to one of our priorities, we absolutely have to be good stewards of our resources, and that's been a key priority. And one of the things from the time I walked in is our goal, actually our standard, is to maintain audible at any time. And so I did go down with Mr. Stuckey, and he did not want to hand over an issue to the new director of OEM. So he and I know Sean's been working with us from day one to resolve and address all those issues. If our state, we don't have a lot of resources, so we're going to manage it to the absolute best of our ability.
Yes, sir. That sounds good. Next question has to do with the State Defense Force and your comments on House Bill 2428 as a housekeeping measure. Are we talking the State Defense Force that used to be deployed to the EOCs during disasters, because they actually played a significant role in 2007-2008 during responses? What's the state of the State Defense Force?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Evans, when we reviewed the State Defense Force, and as you saw from our organization within the state, we're actually re-looking at their exact role on what we want them to do. And so what we're doing right now is we're going to basically start from the scratch again, because we looked across the organization and we wanted to make sure, number one, they're trained for what we want them to do, mm-hmm. and that one of the things we were concerned about is misrepresentation. What I have learned from other areas is we want to make sure that they're recognized and not misrecognized as military personnel. And so the process, we're actually relooking the regulation. It's in its final draft right now. And Mr. Stuckey and I and Mr. Foray, before Mr. Stuckey, had worked on this very closely, and the leadership of the State Defense Force. And so the way ahead at this point, what we're going to do is stand down the organization, mm-hmm. get a list of all the members. We're going to complete the regulation, which is almost completed at this point. And then what we're going to do is reestablish what their role is, what their missions are, what the requirements are to be a member, to make sure that we have a thorough understanding of who's in the organization. And then we'll bring them back in to do the mission sets that we think best support the state.
So just so I understand, the organization is effectively either dead or on hold. You're reclassifying and relooking at what they do.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, representative, yes, it's on hold till we get a clear mission set and we know what training we're conduct with them and the roles and missions that we'll have them operating under.
Okay. As a follow-up to that question, offline, my concern about that is commanding officers of units rotate in and out, and the ability of the State Defense Force to create relationships as liaisons inside the EOC probably saved lives, certainly saved property in 2007-2008. So I'd like to make sure we don't lose the baby with the bathwater on that one.
Yes, sir.
Chair Lively, next question is on the slide that located the armories. It had the Oregon Military Academy there. Yes. Is that still being moved out of my town?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Evans, not at this time, but it is a proposal. Western Oregon had asked for the opportunity to potentially purchase that facility.
If you guys were leaving.
Yes, sir. And we have, I believe it's a year and a half, it's a 25-year required lease that we have to maintain that facility. And so we are working with them to determine the way forward for that.
Okay, just key point, it's the only military academy, I believe, on a college in the United States still.
Yes, sir.
At least until it's taken. Yes, okay. Next question. Do we have 7 Chinooks? I saw on your slide, sir, we had 7. I thought we only had 3 or 4.
Okay. Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Evans, we're in a position where that unit might be going someplace soon. As a result, they're going to upgrade. It gives us the opportunity to upgrade our Delta models to a F model Chinook. which is a much greater capability.
Right.
Right now, we have a float aircraft, so we have seven. We're normally assigned six in Pendleton, but we are going to begin, we believe, as early as April, a transition to a new airframe. To address specifically that, if the unit does deploy, we are working to get some of those aircraft to remain behind so we retain the firefighting capability that we normally have throughout the year. And we're looking at making sure we have the right number of air crew members in the rear as well.
Chair Lively, sure. General Hokanson, the question, thank you for clarifying that, because I know when we lost the C-23s, we lost some very essential capability to move folks around during those type of disasters, so I want to be cognizant of that. Really, last two issues have to do with the new director at OEM and the playbook. Mm-hmm. I've reviewed the playbook. I think it's a very good start. There are some questions I have in terms of assets and long-term investments that I know Representative Boone will probably be having many of the same questions I have about. I just ask if it's possible to give us a brief on where we are in terms of that particular playbook as we go throughout the session. That's the question and the request. And thank you for your answers. I appreciate your time.
Other representatives?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Hokanson, is there a way that we can get a copy of the playbook? I think that's the one that Director McConnell said they only printed a few of, and I don't know if that's, I'm trying to remember things. Yes.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Boone, we only printed about 225 initially because we've got, as Representative has pointed out, when I briefed the governor, this is version 1.0, which is actually version 90 for us. and it before it's really functional to the point where we figure about the 50-60% product, but we had to get something out right away in case, because we don't control the timeline. But the intent is it's probably going to take us 2 or 3 years to get to where we have the 80-90% product, which is our goal. And so we can provide those as long as they're available. I know we have a 2-page, which is a brief summary of it, which is extremely helpful. And the level of detail is actually out with all of the agencies that would be responsible for this so that they can provide us feedback on how to improve it. Our next version comes out on the 1st of July, and we'll print much more of those because this is probably around the 60-70% effort. So I'll work with the Office of Emergency Management to get copies as soon as we can.
Follow up.
Certainly, go ahead.
Is it possible for us to get that 2-pager then at this point or soon? And I don't want to pressure you to disclose something that you're not ready to let go for, but just so we have an idea of who's on first.
We'll get those to you today, ma'am.
Oh, thank you.
So we can share that with the committee members. Yeah. Other questions or follow up at this point?
I just have one.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to also let you know, over the years, I've been invited to attend the graduation for the Champion Youth Challenge, and for some weird reason, I'm never able to go. And so I just want you to pass along to your troops there that it's not that I'm not interested. I fully intend to do it as much as possible if I can. Seemed to fall on something that I always had scheduled, so I will make a real effort the next year. So.
Any other questions, comments? Anything else from you?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, nothing else from me. Thank you once again for this opportunity. And if at any time in the future you have any questions at all, please let us know. One thing that I've said from the day I arrived is we are a 100% transparent organization. We answer the public. If you have a question about anything, we will absolutely tell you what we can immediately.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate you taking the time, all of you, for being here today, and we look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Anything else from the committee? Not. Our next meeting is Thursday, February 5th, and we will adjourn. And we will adjourn.